Welcome to Ouroboros Podcast, episode number 193. I am your host, Colin, coming to you from Bath. More or less back to normal this week, with my usual theme music, and my foot has recovered enough that I can use my regular microphone as well. But this is also a slightly impromptu show. I'm recording a couple of days early because at the time this is released, I will be in London, or at least on my way to London, because at the last minute I got confirmation of the date and location that Irk from the Irk FM podcast, the Irk Pod podcast, the guy's on so many different podcasts, it's untrue. But he's travelling around Europe from Australia, and he's going to be in London this Saturday. So I got my coach ticket, and I'm recording this early so I can release it on Saturday, and go down to London to meet Irk, who I've been talking with online for getting on 3 years. But I've never met him in person, and this might be the only chance I ever get to do so. So I just couldn't let that pass up. So this is kind of a last minute show because of last minute travel plans to going to London. And because of the slightly impromptu nature of this show, I've also got impromptu subject matter to discuss. I'm going to be talking about a few films I haven't given a proper review to yet, and since my film tastes tend to be split between big comic book action films and thoughtful art house films, you can definitely expect to get some eclectic film reviews out of this episode. But of course, we've also got some really good music. And the first track I've got for you is by Catlow. This is Run to Me.
Run to me. Rush to me. Run from you. Rush to you, run to me, rush to me, run from you, rush to you. Me.
Winslow is the stage name for Natasha Thirsk, who comes from Vancouver. And that is pretty much all I can tell you. I got that track off a North by Northeast sampler that the Musebox sent out. Catno has a new EP coming out soon, but other than that, I can tell you nothing. I just think it's a rather catchy, rather quirky little indie electronica number, and I rather liked it, so I decided to play it for you. Okay, let's talk films. And the first one I want to talk about is a Japanese film called Norwegian Wood. Now, this is based on a very popular Japanese novel written by Haruki Murakami, who is one of Japan's most respected authors. And it follows what is basically a love triangle set in Tokyo in the 60s during the time of the students' unrest that was going on all over the world. And it follows this man, well, this boy really, as he decides which of these two women he wants to stay with. This film looks interesting to me. I do like Japanese cinema. One of my favourite films of the year so far has been a Japanese film called Confessions. But this one didn't really grab me, I must admit. It's beautiful. Every shot is beautifully structured, beautifully lit, but it's also kind of empty. It was directed by the French director An Hung Tran, who has been Oscar nominated in the past, and obviously has a very strong visual style. But for me, it actually gets in the way of the film and highlights problems with the film. He tends to have really long, really languorous, silent shots, just showing what's going on with no dialogue and just letting the camera float around. Now, in itself, this is not a problem. Excessively long shots were used to great effect in Children of Men, directed by Alfonso Cuarón. And having extended periods of silence worked very well in The American, directed by Anson Corbijn. But in this case, it just doesn't work. When you have these long shots, it highlights the fact that this is a film. It is acting. And it makes you pay really close attention to what is being said. Now, this was probably intentional on the part of An Hung Tran, but these are people saying the kinds of things you hear in films. These are not people interacting as you would in real life. To be fair, if you really paid attention, I'm sure that criticism could be laid at the majority of films. And I haven't read the original novel, so it could also be a problem with the dialogue style of Haruki Murakami. It's just the fact that these ciphers saying words get highlighted by the fact it follows such long periods of silence. I think the key thing that highlights what I didn't like about this film is probably the most notorious shot in the film. There's one scene which in a lot of ways is the defining scene of the film. It states in bald terms the relationship between what you would probably classify as the two main characters. This is a very emotionally charged scene. It's an emotionally charged situation where these two people are basically bearing their souls and explaining to each other their relationship and where they stand with each other. Now, in any other film, this would just be two people in a room talking, and it would have been powerful. But what Tran does is he sets it in a paddy field. And they're not just standing in this paddy field. They're walking up and down this paddy field. And this entire conversation takes place in one long, continuous shot. And the camera tracks them as they walk down this paddy field, tracks them back. And then the scene goes on so long that it tracks them back a third time. So you've got this really long scene where this tracking shot goes up and down following the action. People have said that this is the longest tracking shot created, or one of the longest tracking shots ever created. I mean, this track that the camera was on must have been a good 300 yards. It was excessively long. So while I'm watching this scene, I'm thinking, this is absolutely beautiful. It is perfectly framed, it is perfectly shot, it's well acted. It's technically brilliant. But that's what I'm taking out of it. It looks beautiful and it's technically impressive, but it doesn't have the emotional impact. And that's what I struggle with Norwegian Wood. So, beautiful, but it's a film where you can see the director's hand, and that is not necessarily a good thing. One of the actresses in Norwegian Wood was Rinko Kikuchi. Now, it's possible you will remember that name, because I, slightly facetiously, it must be said, gave her my personal Best Supporting Actress Oscar in my review of last year's films. She put in a very memorable performance in a film called The Brothers Bloom, where she was almost completely silent, and in a certain way did steal the film. But it wasn't a massive role, and it was slightly comedic, so giving her my Best Supporting Actress nod was a little bit facetious. But I stated then, and I maintain now, that it is very difficult to create a good acting role where you have to remain silent. So when I heard about this other film, where the main character doesn't say anything throughout the entire length of the film, I was very intrigued, to say the least. The film is called Essential Killing, and it is directed by the Polish director Jerzy Skolimowski. And it stars Vincent Gallo, who is much better known as a director, and frankly, he's also very well known as a complete dickhead. But he did win the Best Actor at the Berlin Film Festival last year. So, a award-worthy acting performance, completely silent acting performance. it sounded like an interesting proposition. The basic premise of this film is that Vincent Gallo plays an insurgent in Afghanistan who kills some soldiers and is then renditioned to an unnamed European country to basically be tortured. Through a series of circumstances, he manages to escape and finds himself alone in a snow-filled landscape and desperately trying to survive. And as I said, he is almost completely silent. He says one word in the entire film, and that's a swear word when he gets his foot caught in a bear trap. But other than that, he is completely silent. So this battle for survival, this man doing anything he possibly can just to survive, that could have been a really compelling story. The problem is, it doesn't work. In order for us to care about this battle for survival, we A, need to have a certain amount of sympathy for the protagonist, and B, he needs to have a believable way of actually escaping and surviving. But in this story, we have neither. The first thing we see Vincent Gallo's character do in this film is shoot an American soldier and two American contractors with a rocket launcher, which obviously ends very messily for the Americans. And while this is undoubtedly a despicable act, we could still have had a certain amount of sympathy for the character if we had any idea as to his true motivation for doing this act. I mean, we have certain amounts of flashbacks where we see a woman, presumably his wife, carrying a child. The implication being that this woman has died. But that is never explicitly stated. So if we understand that he has definitely lost his wife and child, and it was definitely the fault of the Americans, we can sympathise with his situation. But because we are never given that absolute confirmation of what happened and why he did this act, all he is a murderer. He is someone who shoots rockets at people standing 20 feet from him. And at other points, he takes a gun from somebody and shoots two people through the head. Oh, there's another scene where he impales somebody on a chainsaw. These are all horrible acts, but they could be understandable acts if we were given full context for this character's situation. But because we are given very, very little information about what this person's background is, he just comes off as a cold-blooded killer with very little remorse. And the other thing that would have made this film more compelling is if he had any believable hope of survival. I mean, this is a person who, at the start of the film, we see in a desert landscape in Afghanistan. And when he manages to escape, it is in a snow-covered forest. It's never explicitly stated, but it was shot in Poland and Norway. So this is a harsh, snowy landscape. For somebody who has almost certainly never seen snow, and has also almost certainly never had any survival training, his survival chances don't look good. I mean, because even if he does get to civilization, he obviously can't speak the local language. So how is he going to communicate the fact that he's not dangerous? When it is patently clear that he is dangerous because of all the people he's killed along the way. This film could have worked. It could have been a lot better if we had sympathy for the protagonist and if he had any modicum of hope of survival. But basically all it is we put a murderer in a snowdrift for an hour and a half. And that just isn't compelling for me. So, that's two art house films and two pretty negative reviews. So later in the show, we're going to have a couple of reviews for slightly more commercial films. But before that, we've got some more music. The next track comes from Kafka, who is a singer-songwriter from Burnley. He has an album out now called Mysterious Skin, and it's got a really intriguing indie pop kind of sound. So, from Burnley, this is Kafka with his track Maybe Later.
Once, when he was a child, he stopped and wondered why he always has to steal, he always has to lie. Still he says, that's my way. When I come back, I'll show you someday.
There's no way out. This is Pete Kogle from Made in the UK.
This is the Grumbler from Made in the UK.
This is Colin from Made in the UK.
I'm Gobble from Made in the UK.
And this is Rowley, Made in the UK. Made in the UK
for the world.
Oh, isn't he bold?
That was Dark End by Sentinel, who come from Oakland in California. I've played them in the past, and in one of my increasingly infrequent trips to MySpace nowadays, I noticed that that single, Dark End, was available as a free download. So I thought I'd bring it to you. Really nice slice of shoegazy dream pop there. Very relaxing stuff. So, in this rather impromptu show, got some more film reviews to get through. The first one I want to talk about is another film I saw on Blu-ray recently, along with Norwegian Wood and Essential Killing. This one's a much more light-hearted affair. It's an animated film called Gnomeo and Juliet. I did make the comment a couple of weeks ago when I talked about Cars 2 and Kung Fu Panda 2 that this is a golden age of animation. And I actually think that Gnomeo and Juliet adds to that idea. It's surprisingly fun. It is pretty much based at kids. They are definitely the target market for this film. But it's just really sweet. It's a really nice story. I mean, obviously it's a well-known story. It's based on Romeo and Juliet, if you hadn't guessed already. And while it doesn't really have the same kind of Easter eggs for adults that Pixar tends to put in their films, it's not so juvenile and so based for children that adults can't get anything out of it. I found it entertaining. I found it enjoyable. It's just a really uncomplicated, unthreatening film. And every now and again, that's no bad thing. So now I've got my recent Blu-ray watching out of the way, I'll discuss the last film I saw at the cinema. And as I said at the start of the podcast, my taste in films tends to be split between arthouse films and comic book action films. So I guess that means it's time to talk about the comic book films. I saw Captain America. It's the last film that Marvel is going to release before the Avengers next year. And indeed there was a bit of a teaser for the Avengers at the end of the credits for Captain America, which was very cool. The simple audacity of the Avengers project is impressive to behold, with Marvel creating their own film studio and keeping the rights to all their properties, so they can make an Avengers film with pretty much the same cast. And while the criticism has been levelled at these films, Iron Man and Iron Man 2, Thor, and now Captain America, that they are simply setting the groundwork for the Avengers. In my mind, all of these films stand very well on their own, including Captain America, which I really enjoyed. I must admit, it wasn't one of the comic book films I was really interested in seeing, because Captain America has always been a rather dull character for me. I mean, A, he is Captain America and I'm British, so there's always that risk of jingoism. And B, his powers and his style just aren't that compelling. Or at least I didn't think they were that compelling. Just running about with what is basically a steroid-enhanced body and carrying a shield, it just didn't seem that interesting. But I have to say, I was wrong. What I really enjoyed about Captain America is that it is a very, very different style of film to what we have become accustomed to with the Christopher Nolan Batman, the Watchmen adaptation, and even films like Kick-Ass. We have become accustomed to our superheroes being dark and gritty and based in the real world. And it's no mistake that the first two films I mentioned in that section were Nolan's Batman and Watchmen. Because it is very, very easy to pinpoint the place where comics changed and where our attitudes to comics changed. It was in 1986 when two graphic novels were published, and this was the first time the term graphic novel had been used. And those two graphic novels were The Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller and Watchmen by Alan Moore. After those two books were published and were so successful, Entertainment Weekly actually called Watchmen one of the best books of the last 25 years. Not one of the best comics, one of the best books of the last 25 years. After that amazing success of the Watchmen approach, a certain amount of realism, a certain amount of psychological examination of why you would want to become a hero, a certain amount of violence, even. That's what people expected from their superheroes. So, the golden age of comics back in the 30s and 40s, with fine, upstanding, perfect heroes, seems rather dated and rather old-fashioned. And watching Captain America, I realise that that idea is wrong, or it can be wrong. Sometimes it's good to have a hero who is just really good, and a villain who is really bad. Sometimes you need that. I mean, that is fundamentally what superhero comics and films are about. It's the battle between good and evil. It was amazing to me that Captain America's primary superpower is decency. He is just a really honourable, decent man. Some might say too honourable and too decent. He's perhaps a little bit unbelievable in the modern age where we examine psychology so closely. But that's basically what he is. He is a good man. And even after he gets superpowers, he is still a good man. And that actually helps with the major concern I had with Captain America. And that's the jingoistic aspect of it. Throughout the film, he is not portrayed as a good American. He is portrayed as a good man. It is such a universal idea that it really doesn't matter too much that he is Captain America. He could just as easily be Captain Canada, Captain Venezuela, Captain Indonesia. All he is a good, honest, decent man who wants to fight in the Second World War. And as he says in the film, he doesn't want to kill Nazis. He just doesn't like bullies. And that's kind of the whole ethos behind Captain America. He is this upstanding man with a very 40s attitude. And over recent years, that has been the basis. He gets frozen and then resurrected in the 21st century. So here he is, this decent patriotic hero from the 40s, thawed out and surrounded by much more ambiguous heroes from the 21st century. And that's kind of where they're going, building up to the Avengers. We have Chris Evans playing Steve Rogers, who gets turned into Captain America. And the whole film is just him in the Second World War, and at the end he gets frozen. And it works. There are moments of genuine humour. There's one moment which might have got spoiled by the trailer, but in context of the film, the shot from the trailer is a lot funnier, and the motivations between the people involved are much stronger. It's also really exciting. I mean, there's a legitimate reason why Captain America gets put into the traditional costume with sort of the red, white and blue and the little wings on his helmet and the big shield with the stars and stripes on it. All of that is explained, and explained very well. It kind of examines the difference between expectation and reality. Once Steve Rogers has been given this super serum, you can expect that he will be sent to the front and will be part of the war effort. Instead, he's just basically a singing monkey trying to sell war bonds at home. And it's very well put together. The action scenes are exciting. The villain, played by Hugo Weaving, the Red Skull, is pulled off remarkably well. I mean, that's another problem I've always had with Captain America, is his main villain is the Red Skull, this Nazi general who, instead of a face, has a red skull. But it's pulled off very, very well in the film, and Hugo Weaving, despite all the prosthetics and stuff, does look convincing and suitably evil as the Red Skull. And the Red Skull is also given a line which really tickled me, which personally I think is a reference to Raiders of the Lost Ark. He says something along the lines of, "Hitler can scrabble about in the desert all he wants. What I'm doing here will really win the war." And I believe that that is a reference to the search for the Ark of the Covenant in Raiders of the Lost Ark. So that did tickle me somewhat. And the effects for the Red Skull are really good, and also the effects that they used on Chris Evans. Now, at the start of the film, Steve Rogers, played by Chris Evans, is, you know, the classic £90 weakling, who again and again tries to enlist, but always gets rejected on medical grounds, which is why he is such a strong candidate for this super soldier program. So, towards the start of the film, he is really weedy, really pathetic in a lot of ways. Then he gets the super soldier serum, and he becomes huge and buff. And Chris Evans is totally convincing in both aspects. And perhaps what is the more impressive thing is that the CGI effects used to make Chris Evans look so weedy are totally convincing. This is some really effective use of special effects. Acting like you're an Alice Pound weakling when you're clearly not is difficult enough. But acting at your usual size, but the character isn't used to having this mass, is also difficult, and it really works. And also, for once in a film like this, the love interest is convincing a token Brit named Hayley Atwell. I can't remember what the character's name is, but the actress is Hayley Atwell. And her interactions with Steve Rogers are charming, sweet, kind of funny in places, and totally convincing. I mean, I heard a lot of criticisms of the Thor film that the romance between Thor and Natalie Portman wasn't convincing. Now, personally, I didn't find that, but I can kind of understand where people are coming from. But the romantic subplot between Chris Evans and Hayley Atwell, I found totally believable, totally acceptable, and rather fun. So overall, Captain America was surprisingly good. I only really went to see it because I wanted all the background for the Avengers film next year. But I actually found it really enjoyable. So all I can say is, roll on the Avengers next year. I'm now even more excited to see it, especially as it's being directed by Joss Whedon, who is one of my media heroes. So on to the next bit of music. And here's another play for La Rez, who come from New York. Here's another politically charged rock track from their album Revolution. This is definitely a band with a conscience, and every now and again that's not such a bad thing. But if it comes to dominate your style like it has recently with the Manic Street Preachers, it can get rather wearing. But La Rez are still on their first album, so it's still rather fresh and interesting, and I really like it. So, from New York, this is La Rez with their track, The Drop.
That kept me enslaved. Get out of my way. Well, after all this time, I figured out why I let the cloud follow me with all of his rain. I guess I like the pain. I tried to run for myself, but I couldn't escape. Yeah.
Okay, then. Go ahead. Criticize me. I'm ready.
I have nothing to criticize. You are so totally grounded in self-confidence. You make goth look gorgeous and fun.
I'm not a goth. I'm a scientist.
There's another play for the So Goth It Hurts band Dark Souls Day, who come all the way from Salonika in Greece. And that track, Lifeless, is another one off their EP X Lives, which you can get from the excellent net label AF Music. So next week's show is more than likely going to be full of lots of field recordings I make on the Irk crawl. Let's hope that my foot doesn't completely collapse on me, because it's going to be the longest time I'm going to be wearing shoes for about 2 weeks. Something of a daunting prospect. The hiatus for Wiki Music Video Podcast is going to be coming to an end soon. Plans are in the pipelines for improvements to that show. Although I've given up trying to get the HD feed accepted by the iTunes store, it's just too much of a pain in the ass when they won't even tell you why they've rejected it. I will be continuing with the HD feeds, and WMVP will be returning soon. And as I've mentioned over recent weeks, I have been catching up with all my music podcasts. and I've reached November for last year, which has made me contemplate attempting Napod Pomo again. And that is the project where you release a podcast a day throughout the month of November. And I've kind of been contemplating whether to do it or not. I think the plan would be, instead of releasing one podcast a week with six tracks, I would just release a track a day and have any other conversations or thoughts that occur to me on that particular day in the show. I'm not sure. If anybody's got any strong feelings one way or the other, let me know. I mean, would you be open to having a daily 15-minute podcast instead of a weekly hour and a quarter one? Let me know. Robberus.podcast@gmail.com.
What ho, my good man? I would like to talk to your master about Weird Track of the Week.
Well, I'll ask him, but I don't think he'd be very interested. We've already got one, you see. It's out the back. It's very nice, too. Now go away, or I will taunt you a second time.
Sometimes what makes a Weird Track of the Week is the entire concept, the entire ethos behind the music. And this week's track is no exception. The artist is Dragonfly Lingo, which is the stage name for Mitya Wexler from Rouen in France. And he has created, I suppose you'd call it a concept album, called Off Screen. What he has done is create some dark industrial electronica tracks inspired by different films, and then used samples of the films in the tracks. So the music is both inspired by and features dialogue and feelings from specific films. It's a common technique to use samples from films in a dance track, but to have it so totally integrated into the project is something a little bit special, and I think it sounds really good. This particular track uses samples from the David Cronenberg classic Videodrome, which is a really freaky film, and in a lot of ways is the most Cronenberg of all Cronenberg films. So from Rouen in France, and off the album Off Screen, this is Dragonfly Lingo with his track I've Got Your Number. See you next time, and remember, good music is infinite.
You're going insane. I can hear you disintegrating while you talk to me. I can hear you disintegrating while you talk to me. I can hear you disintegrating while you talk to me.
But I do. I do.
Now.
you, lover.
You have been listening to Colin and the Ouroboros podcast. Good music is infinite.